This is Central Coast Public Radio, KCBX. I'm Tyler Pratt. It's time for Issues and Ideas, a show that features a wide variety of local voices sharing their thoughts and perspectives. Today, a fast food chain on the Cal Poly campus is at the center of a conversation about diversity and inclusion at the university.
This is more about an identification of a direct conflict with our advertised values.
And later, we'll learn about what's prompted local educators to start teaching media literacy in San Luis Obispo County Schools.
With the rise of fake news in the media as a discussion point, has been a real motivator to see some change in this space.
These stories and more coming up on Issues and Ideas. Good afternoon. It's Monday, May 13th, 2019. I'm Tyler Pratt. We begin today's show with an issue at Cal Poly that's been sweeping the internet over the past week. University faculty in San Luis Obispo voted last week to remove a Chick-fil-A fast food outlet from campus. This follows the recent news that the restaurant's charity arm donated millions to anti-LGBTQ organizations across the country in 2017. And actions by another U.S. university and two other cities to block Chick-fil-A's from opening. But at Cal Poly, the fast food outlet may get to remain on campus despite opposition. Tom Gutierrez is a Cal Poly physics professor who brought the matter to the Academic Senate, the governing body for faculty.
For me, this is more about an identification of a direct conflict with our advertised values that are publicly displayed on many websites.
Cal Poly has recently devoted resources to promoting diversity and inclusion at the school for several incidents, including a frat party where a student wore blackface and it was posted on social media.
I think the thing that's been driving the strategic ideas of the administration on inclusivity and diversity is really driven by the conspicuous lack of diversity on campus.
Chick-fil-A came under fire in 2012 when the company's CEO made public remarks opposing same-sex marriage. A Cal Poly spokesperson said Cal Poly has never received a complaint of discrimination at the restaurant on campus and says the university doesn't agree with the Chick-fil-A CEO's past statements, but that ending its relationship with the company would be, quote, its own form of intolerance. Here's Professor Gutierrez again.
If your value statements and your mission statements are not informing business decisions, then I don't understand what the purpose of the value and mission statements are.
The Academic Senate voted overwhelmingly to sever ties with Chick-fil-A, but it's a symbolic vote. Gutierrez says he doesn't expect Cal Poly's administration to take any action on the matter. He has encouraged student activists to press the issue. The Chick-fil-A on campus was one of the company's most profitable last year, and it's the chain's only location at a CSU. There are 113 Chick-fil-A's across the state. What's the fiscal future for the city of San Luis Obispo, according to city leaders? Uncertain. San Luis Obispo city officials gave the second annual State of the City address Thursday, and there were plenty of accomplishments to highlight, like creating the largest bank of electric vehicle charging stations in the state of California at a downtown parking garage. But looking at the year ahead,
there were two words that I had to characterize kind of where the city is, as cautionary and encouraging.
That's city manager Derek Johnson.
I think that we've developed a fiscal forecast that is going to require a tremendous amount of discipline by the community and by the council and by the staff in order for us to deliver on the services and the capital improvement projects and keep our focus on paying down our unfunded liability.
Which is $150 million in pensions the city is responsible for, but doesn't have.
It is a result of the market losses during the Great Recession.
Johnson said bad investments were made during that time, combined with the fact
people are living longer. Also, public employees were not seeing the wage increases that were forecasted.
And all this comes as a swath of city employees may be getting ready to cash out.
For example, the utilities department, nearly 40% of that department is eligible for retirement in the next few years.
So the city may be taking a cautious approach to funding projects over the next year, but there is still that encouraging part that was mentioned mentioned before. Johnson and Mayor Heidi Harmon said the city has continued to see revenue increases from sales, property, and that transient occupancy tax at hotels. And Harmon says new increased fees on developments in the city may help pay for
transportation, infrastructure, parks, public safety, water, and sewer.
You can see a video of the full presentation on the City of San Luis Obispo government Facebook page. And the City Council will finalize San Luis Obispo's budget for the next fiscal year in June. Moving now to Santa Barbara, the city's attorney Ariel Colon recently talked of issuing new injunctions aimed to curb disruptive and aggressive behaviors in Santa Barbara city parks. The move would criminalize some conduct, however, no exact behaviors were specifically identified. Supporters of the order feel that families and children have been pushed out of city parks because they are fearful of the aggressive or lewd behavior of some visitors. Opponents of the injunction question its constitutionality and feel it could unfairly target some individuals. Some suggested creating a day center where homeless residents could bring their belongings and hang out for the day. It was also suggested that those centers could provide a place to relax, homeless services, bathrooms, and showers. In another move, $2.2 million in state funding will go to support more services for the Santa Barbara City homeless. This funding directly benefits Santa Barbara Cottage Hospital, which will add a nurse and other services to address the emergency medical needs of those living on the street. And the city is likely to bring in several other specialists in the service areas as well. To help break down this issue, here's a segment from sister station KCRW's podcast, The 805, where host Jonathan Bastian speaks with Nick Welsh, executive director of the Santa Barbara Independent.
Last week, the city attorney kind of stepped up and is talking about potential injunctions. Back us up a little bit. What happened there?
Okay, so it was sort of a CinemaScope presentation of everything that's happening with homelessness in Santa Barbara. And it was a four-hour-long meeting, and Ariel Colon, the city's attorney, kind of surprised the heck out of everybody by somewhere like hour three, sort of coming up with the idea saying, hey, by the way, we're thinking about an injunction against, he didn't say homeless people, but against certain unlawful behaviors, particularly in city parks, which have been hard hit, or some of them have been very hard hit by homeless people who have been acting up. You know, nobody had heard about an injunction before. It was sort of an off-menu item. And it sort of raises a lot of civil libertarian red flags.
Yeah, and I mean, this, I believe, follows fear from parents or local community members that said, I don't feel safe being in some of these parks. And the idea behind the injunction, if I'm correct, is it would basically say, individual X, you're not allowed to be in this area anymore, and we can take legal action now if we do see you there. Is that correct?
Right. I mean, the details were not spelled out, but, you know, just to put it in some perspective, two things kind of came out in this hearing. One, what we've been hearing in the city of Santa Barbara is that the actual number of homeless people is going down.
Yeah.
At the same time, the impact of homeless people who hang out in certain parks has been going up. And sort of the nuisance behavior that people complain about, the complaints have been going up. You know, children and families are made to feel uncomfortable by, you know, abusive verbal, you know, attacks and things like that. So it came out of that discussion.
Yeah. Now, if we also talk about what's going on at the same time, it's the $2.2 million that the city has received from the state. And just to kind of dovetail off what you're saying, that money, or very little of it, is actually going towards housing, but a lot of it's going towards a lot of other services. Maybe could help with what we're talking about. Say more about that.
Yeah, so everybody subscribes to this notion of housing first,
right?
Now, which is in order to get people to make the life changes that they need to get off the streets and into housing, you need to get them into housing first, and then you can get them all the services. Well, in Santa Barbara, we don't have much of that housing. Initially, we were thinking we were going to get a $6 million grant, and there was talk about putting like 40, you know, trailers on a parking lot downtown, and that would function as homeless housing, emergency homeless housing. That deal fell through. It was the neighbors came unglued, and we didn't get the money. So it was a non-starter. So you had $2 million, 2.2. So what we got instead is we have a couple of new players to the table that haven't really been at the table, or certainly not with the vigor that they now will be. Cottage Hospital, which really always has to be the 900-pound gorilla in any room, they have now stepped up in a really big way, and they have committed to providing a registered nurse, a nurse to go out on rounds with city restorative cops,
right,
to sort of deal with some of the high volume users, people who get arrested a lot, people who go to the ER a lot, people who get cited a lot, people who are in trouble a lot. How do you get them to get the treatment? How do you get them the psychiatric care, the medical care that they need? So that's brand new. You have the city police involved in a way as well that's kind of new. And then they brought in this group from Orange County. It's called CityNet. It's a faith-based group. Did a lot of work on the in Anaheim on the San Ynez River, clearing out homeless camps there. And they're going to go out and, you know, confront or encounter or develop trust, is what they say, with, you know, the top 50. They have a reputation for being very assertive and very relentless. People here who do the same sort of outreach work have looked at them with some begrudgingness. They're getting $900,000 of a $2 million grant. Why can't we do that? We do that job ourselves. So,
and does it not surprise you, or did it not kind of raise a red flag that it is a faith-based organization?
You know, a lot of people have made that point. I think the reality is, if you look at people who are dealing with the homeless, many of them are faith-based. Mm. And if you try to get that out of the equation, you're going to lose a large segment of the service providers. I think when you're trying to push the boulder up the hill, it helps to have a little supernatural wind at your back, and at least to keep you going.
Sure.
But a lot of people have expressed concern, you know, about some of the religious affiliations.
Yeah.
More to the point, they've raised concern more practically. They say, you know, you're bringing in three street outreach workers. Great. Two of them have absolutely no history working with the homeless before. Three of them are from out of town. Mm-hmm. So that kind of puts them at a disadvantage. And the locals who feel unfairly excluded from competing for this money have asked, what's the secret sauce that makes them a force multiplier? What do they got that we ain't got?
Yeah. Well, as you said, I mean, this, if we think about everything we've just spoken about here, it definitely is a very confusing message, which is, are we going to take a more traditional law enforcement approach with injunctions, or are we going to go about this kind of restorative or healing-based approach? And I don't know, do you think these things can work in harmony, or are they kind of in opposition to each other?
You got a whole lot of people on the dance floor who have never been on the dance floor together. So how that unfolds, we'll see. You know, what you have here, though, what's interesting is that the chief of police, Lori Lunau, has really been very clear that she isn't interested in trying to enforce our way out of the situation. She doesn't think that's possible. And so you don't really have a big appetite from law enforcement to get tough. Plus, you don't have room in the jail.
Mm.
So it's really not a great option.
That's Nick Welsh, executive editor at the Santa Barbara Independent. Nick, thanks as always.
Hey, man, thank you.
You're listening to Issues and Ideas on KCBX. I'm Taylor Pratt. A 15-acre fiber optic art installation is coming to Paso Robles. Sensorio is situated on the east side of Paso Robles, directly across Highway 46 from Hunter Golf Course. Field of Light at Sensorio is the creation of internationally acclaimed artist Bruce Munro, who installed a similar light installation in the Australian outback. Sensorio will be open to the public this Sunday and runs through January 2020. 15 volunteers are presently completing the installation of more than 58,000 fiber optic stemmed lights that morph through a palette of luminous colors undulating through the countryside. It's reminiscent of stepping into a forest scene from the movie Avatar. Join Sensorio's executive director, Tracy Strand, as she shares insights about the installation with correspondent Tom Wilmer.
Hi, my name is Tracy Strand. I'm executive director of Sensorio.
Sensorio, this is a new iteration, a new evolution in the Paso Robles North County region, isn't it?
It is. Nothing like this has ever been done before. It's a 380-acre installation right across the street from Hunter Ranch Golf Course and next to Eberly Winery.
And when you say installation, this is kind of a futuristic art installation that somebody has to see to believe.
Yeah, it's really the intersection of art, technology, and nature. And it will be opened in three iterations. But the first phase opens on May 19th of this year, and it is Field of Light at Sensorio by Bruce Monroe, the internationally acclaimed outdoor installation artist.
Tell us about his Australian Outback installation. That sounds incredible.
It's 50,000 lights, and it's at the base of Uluru, which is Ayers Rock in the Australian Outback. And Ken Hunter and his wife Bobby were traveling there 4 years ago and came upon it and were so blown away that they felt that they should bring this to Paso Robles and to the Central Coast.
Tell us about the scope and breadth of the experience.
It is the largest outdoor light installation Bruce Monroe has ever done in the world. It is 15 acres, 60,000 lights. It takes a staff of 15 to 20, 8 hours a day, 5 days a week for 5 weeks to install. It is a breathtaking, once-in-a-lifetime experience.
And so all these lights are LEDs and they're all solar-powered, correct?
They are. Everything that we are doing here on the property is solar-powered.
It's an immersive, walking, floating experience almost.
Yeah, we hope that it's going to be inspirational, meditative. When you enter, you'll be able to have some beer and some wine and have something to eat. We also have a VIP experience where a very limited number of people, 150 a night, will be able to experience a gourmet picnic dinner up on a VIP terrace.
Overlooking the light installation.
Overlooking the light installation. Mm-hmm. And then you take your time and you walk through the 15 acres at your leisure and be immersed in the beauty that is this exhibit.
So it's a series of meandering pathways that somebody walks along and
it
walks
is.
Into the experience.
And it's in a canyon, so you are immersed. You walk through at the base of the canyon with the light surrounding you.
And the lighting go through iterations of color change?
They do. It's all solar. There are projectors with color wheels that turn and change the colors of the lights.
Every day it'll be open?
Wednesday through Sunday from 7 p.m. to 11 p.m.
I seem to recall you have a family night?
We do. On Wednesday nights, all kids are half price. This will be open until January 5th, and then next summer, we will be building an event center as well. So there'll be a permanent wine center here on the property, and then in 2021, Sensorio will open, which is really a cross between a very high-end, immersive attraction experience and a native botanical garden.
So as we're standing on a promontory overlooking the installation in process, there's a field of workers out there.
Yeah, this couldn't happen without them. So four of Bruce Monroe's staff from England have come over for 5 weeks to live in Paso Robles and do the installation. And then we hired four local artists to assist for the 5 weeks. And then we have our army of volunteers. So people from all over the region are coming for 4 hour intervals to assist in the installation.
And they volunteer because of their love of art?
They do, and wanting to be a part of something that's really a once in a lifetime experience.
And how did word go out to the local volunteers?
Well, we did it through a lot of the chambers, through the destination marketing organizations, but mostly through our website, which is sensoriopaso.com. Mm-hmm. And you can still go online and go to sensoriopaso.com, click on volunteer, and you can sign up for 1, 2, 3, 5 shifts. If you sign up for more, 3 or more shifts, then you get free tickets and you're really a part of our family.
That's really cool. And on your website, somebody can get a visual picture of the field of light.
Yes, you can really get an idea of what it's going to look like.
Tracy Strand, thank you so much for sharing.
Thank you for coming out.
I'm going to come back at nighttime when the lights are lit.
Yes, please.
Yeah. I'm Tom Wilmer reporting from Paso Robles, California.
You're listening to Issues and Ideas on KCBX. Next, in 2019, Joe Guzzardi started his new job as San Luis Obispo County's Emergency Services Director. He's one of the key officials calling the shots if and when emergencies and disasters hit our region. Here's KCBX's Greta Mart in conversation with Joe Guzzardi.
Tell us a bit about your background.
Well, I'm a certified emergency manager, and I've been in the business of emergency management for about 20 years. In 1998, I started with County Office of Emergency Services in Santa Barbara. And then a few years ago, I moved up to Santa Clara and worked for that OES for about 3.5 years.
So tell me, I mean, what does an Office of Emergency Services Director do?
The Office of Emergency Services is more of an umbrella organization that helps coordinate response to a large emergency or disaster. So what we do is we work with law enforcement, fire, emergency medical services, public works, and we help them or we support them when they respond to a big incident. When an incident first breaks out, somebody calls 911. If it's a responsible party like All American Pipeline, their duty is to contact the emergency center through 911 dispatch. But the bottom line is we end up hearing in our OES office about an incident that breaks out. Now, initially, our job is to watch and monitor, and if the emergency responders can handle it without our support, then we just stand back and wait for them to ask. We assist in supplying roadblocks for law enforcement to do an evacuation zone. We assist in working with the Red Cross to open up shelters so that people can go to a shelter when they evacuate their homes. And then in a very big incident, if the state or if FEMA gets involved, we assist with coordinating the assistance from the state or from FEMA. And when it gets up to a presidential declaration and FEMA steps in, it becomes a very complex incident that we help assist with, because the firefighters and law enforcement folks are not going to deal directly with FEMA. That's the job of the Office of Emergency Services.
Plains All American Pipeline, they were found guilty of a felony charge for not contacting. So tell me about that.
Yeah, that was a complicated situation because it's very unique. So when it comes to the oil companies, our office oversees their compliance with exercising response to a spill. So our job is to make sure that they're prepared to respond to an incident that might occur with their pipeline. In that case, they were required to test the pipeline, and apparently the testing did not discover flaws in the pipe. And also when it leaked, there was some hiccups with alarms along the pipeline or shutdown of the pipeline. So mistakes were made. I believe they were found guilty of making some of those mistakes. And then what happens is the oil spilled. And unfortunately, it was a very bad situation because when the oil spilled from the break in that pipeline, it just happened to be in a culvert and a drainage that led straight to the beach. So all the oil that came out of that pipe literally just drained down to Refugio Beach. There was some significant delays in reporting that leak, which meant that the leak lasted longer than it may have if they had reported sooner. And I think that was part of what they were found guilty on, is not reporting in a timely manner. Now, following the oil spill from that pipeline, they are required by law, federal and state law, to clean up the mess that they created. So it's not the job of first responders from the county to clean up the mess. It's our job to oversee them while the owner of the pipeline cleans up the mess. So it's a very different scenario from a wildfire.
Right. Or the Montecito debris flow.
Correct.
Where it's
the first responders respond and save victims, try to save victims, rescue victims, and then search for folks afterwards. So it's the Refugio oil spill is a different animal. There's a lot of state and federal agencies that get involved in the aftermath of that. So our emergency center was full of a lot of state and federal folks that were dealing with interfacing with All American Pipeline.
Okay, and so here in San Luis Obispo County, besides the threat of wildfires, maybe some flooding, but of course we have Diablo Canyon Power Plant. I'd assume that a big part of your job is going to be familiarizing yourself. Have you gone on a tour yet at Diablo Canyon?
Yeah, so when I was with Santa Barbara County, I was originally assigned to the nuclear power program from the Santa Barbara County side. So we used to have partial responsibility for dealing with the plant, and that was monitoring and decontamination. We'd have folks, we expected folks would be coming down to Santa Maria. We would be doing some detection, monitoring, and decontamination in Santa Maria for folks that would evacuate in the case of an incident. So I've been a representative from Santa Barbara County to the Emergency Center in San Luis Obispo before. And then more recently, near the end of my career in Santa Barbara County, I was reassigned to the nuclear power program. So I'm very familiar with the plant. I've been on tours, I think, twice there. But basically what we do in San Luis Obispo County is the number one concern is working with PG&E and Diablo Canyon. There are very strict regulations that come down from the Nuclear Regulatory Commission and from FEMA on how the plant trains and exercises and plans and prepares for any potential incidents that might occur. So our office is quite a bit of our revenue comes from a program wherein PG&E pays to the state of California, and then the state provides us revenue to do that job, to oversee PG&E and to make sure that the training and exercise happens properly. Now that the plant is going to be decommissioning, so in the next 5 years or so, it's expected to shut down completely. There's a big concern about us losing that revenue. There's a concern about whether or not the risk from the plant will be decreasing or not, because some of the fuels are still going to be, the spent fuels are still going to be on the property. So we're still monitoring that very closely. We're still following all the NRC and the FEMA requirements. No one is going to be turning away from the responsibilities of dealing with PG&E. However, our county administrator and the county board of supervisors, in forward thinking, they want to start sort of shifting our focus also to wildfires and floods and earthquakes that we might face here. In the past, we've been sort of obsessed with the plant and nothing else, or maybe to a lesser degree, the other things. We're just trying to shift our focus a little bit and pay attention to the things that happen day to day here.
A lot of people were really concerned with their bankruptcy. You know, what does that mean? We're left with this nuclear waste here. So what can you say on that topic?
So fortunately, there's a lot of mechanisms in place so that they can't just walk away from the plant. There's a fund that has been created for decommissioning that I've been told is completely exempt and separate from the bankruptcy. That's a protection that we've been assured is going to be there now and through any kind of Chapter 11 process. It basically, what we're facing is a plan over the next 5 or 6 years of getting to shutdown, and then a plan further on of dealing with the spent fuels and whether or not they actually remove the fuels from the property or they dry, what they call dry cask them there on site. So there's a long-term plan. As I said, no one's turning their attention away from the responsibilities we have in monitoring all that. And again, like I've been assured that the bankruptcy is not going to affect the decommissioning funding that's been set aside already during the process.
So what would you like people to know if there is an immediate and catastrophic, and an emergency like that? Like, what should people do? I mean, it's so hard to know what to do.
So in this community, because of the fact that we've been living with this plant for, I think, close to 40 years, we've been advertising quite a bit about folks paying attention to the sirens. There's a siren system that is set up throughout the county. The sirens direct you to tune in to radio stations to get news from the our office, the Emergency Operations Center, or the first responders, or PG&E. And then depending on conditions, so when you say if something bad happens, well, it's a lot of it's going to depend on what happens, how significant that is, the wind direction on the day that might happen. And so immediately what we expect folks to do is tune in to the radio stations that they're directed to tune into to get information. We also have the capabilities of using emergency alert system and the wireless emergency alert system to notify folks. They'll get information specific to that incident and be told what to do. We've been doing this for for 40 years dealing with the fact that we have a nuclear power plant in our backyard. And I've been through a lot of these exercises myself. They're incredibly detailed. I feel just as safe living here as I would anywhere in the state of California. The power plant is under so much strict regulation, exercising and training, that I feel very comfortable.
Lately, ever since the Thomas Fire and the Montecito debris flow, they keep calling mandatory evacuations of people who live near the burn scars. It seems to me such a fine line, because you, Peter and the Wolf, you cry wolf too many times, people stop, we're not going to pay any attention because they're calling them all the time and nothing ever happens now. And so tell me about making that decision. It seems such a hard decision.
That's a hard one. Let me start at the beginning. The Thomas Fire burned quite a bit of acreage up in the National Forest above Montecito specifically. Unfortunately, when something like that happens, that hillside is exposed for several years because it takes a while for the vegetation to come back and help protect that soil and keep it from coming down the hill. If we get an intense rain, it can impact that hillside. As we saw the debris flow, we can get massive flows of mud and rocks and debris that come down. You saw the destruction. You saw how that can just tear a house apart and carry it all the way down to the beach practically. That's an unfortunate reality after a severe fire like that, and then the intense rains follow. It's easy to predict where that mud will go, because historically you can see where the drainages are. You can see all those ravines and the creeks and the drainages. And so what Santa Barbara has done, they have the debris flow map, and the areas that are in danger, I think they're in red.
Yes.
On that map. So when the Weather Service predicts intense rains that might cause another debris flow, unfortunately those folks need to get out of the way. It's simple physics. And as you said, the hard part for us in government is we don't want to cry wolf. We want to give them good, solid information on what they need to do and when they need to do it. Unfortunately, some of the storms that we received recently, the atmospheric rivers, they call them, and there's another term I forget right now, but some of them are incredibly difficult to predict until right before they hit. So I think you saw that. I think you saw Santa Barbara evacuate folks in one of the storms, and it turned out to be a non-event. The last evacuation, however, I think was quite justified, because you saw mud and debris hit the 101 freeway, and they had to close the freeway. So it's a difficult situation to be in. I've always said in the 20 years I've been in this business, the most difficult incidents to work with are the weather ones. If you have a wildfire, you know where it is and where it's going. The wind's blowing, the fire's burning, and you know you need to get people out of the way.
Right.
That's a no-brainer. Mm-hmm. When you have weather coming in, a storm, and they're predicting a half inch or an inch or an inch and a half, and they're not sure exactly where or what time, those are the hard ones. The overall message from our office is the more that you're prepared, the more that the public is prepared, the safer you can be, because we only have so many first responders. And they're not going to be able to take care of everyone at the same time when we have a severe incident. So just have a family plan, have a business plan, be prepared to take care of yourself as much as you can. And you can Google, you can go to the Red Cross, you can go to you can Google it, and it's all the usual stuff: protective gear, water, flashlight, a crank radio so that you can listen to the radio without having to have power. And just pay attention. Pay attention to the radio. Pay attention to your phone if you get a wireless emergency alert. Follow the directions that you get from first responders or the county or the cities.
Thank you for coming into KCBX.
Thanks very much. Glad to be here.
That was KCBX's Greta Mart in conversation with San Luis Obispo County Emergency Services Director Joe Guzzardi. You're listening to Issues and Ideas on KCBX. I'm Taylor Pratt. The written word defines and empowers human beings. Host Brian Reynolds recently sat down with local graphic artist and author Debbie Miklas to learn about the many benefits of reading and the challenges and threats it's facing.
I've always had a natural gift just for drawing and art, and always had a vivid imagination. And I started I wrote this book, actually, when I was about 12. And I had an idea that I wanted to be a writer, and I just had this in my head. And so the manuscript is actually from that time.
Now, the manuscript would be The Christmas Mistake?
Yes.
Let's talk about that a little bit.
Yeah, it's The Perfect Christmas Mistake. I had a little bit of trouble coming up with exactly the right title for it, but I really thought that that was appropriate because the story centers around kind of a cranky queen and a feast they have each year where all the people in the kingdom and beyond bring a special dish. And some of these dishes are special order. And the queen has a very low tolerance for mistakes. But when the special order candy sticks don't come the way they are supposed to, they turn out to be the perfect mistake for Christmas.
And I'm guessing that would be a curved stick.
Yes.
Right, like a candy cane.
Yes, the first candy cane.
Where can people get this book?
If people enter in Google, The Perfect Christmas Mistake.
And that's the best way to
go. It will come up.
Awesome.
And I have a web page for it, and I have a Facebook page for it. And in the list there, it will be on the first page in a Google search. And it will also show the Amazon link. It's easy to find.
Let's talk a little bit about the value of reading, the joys of reading. It probably starts in the womb, don't you think?
I think it probably does. And from there, I think it's the mother's voice that the developing child hears and becomes accustomed to and comforted by. And I think it's very important just to talk. I just think there are so many benefits to reading. It's really hard to remember all of them. And from the research that I've done about it, I mean, I've always loved reading from the time I was a small child. And so it was a natural thing for me to just read to my children. And it was just a wonderful time for us at the end of the day. It established a schedule. It was a bonding time for us. And there was opportunity for questions and all these things. And studies have shown that children with limited vocabularies, if they are being read to, then their vocabulary will increase and their school success will increase because of what reading does, a story.
Right.
It's
how humans learn. We learn by stories, usually with a beginning, a middle, and an end.
Mm-hmm.
And towards the end of the middle, there's usually some kind of climax or crisis
mm-hmm.
where the heroine is tied to a railroad track and the hero comes and ties her and then they get married, you know. But it's a story format that's
mm-hmm.
linear. And
mm-hmm.
unfortunately, the internet isn't organized that way. And
mm-hmm.
so we certainly encourage reading a narrative, a book, a poem, anything, a short story, a newspaper article, as an antidote to spending time online.
Mm-hmm.
We also know that there's different stages of life where reading is essential. And, for example, most children learn to read in the first and second grade, sometimes
mm-hmm.
earlier. But science shows that if they struggle and don't get help, don't get remediation, they tend to fall behind forever. They don't really catch up and get frustrated. Tell me the story you told me earlier about the middle school teacher.
Oh, yeah. That was really, really interesting. There's a middle school in Wisconsin, I believe it was, and this teacher, Timothy Dolan, he started teaching language arts to eighth graders there, and his co-teacher suggested that he get familiarized with the novels that they were going to be reading throughout the year and informed him that they would be reading aloud to the eighth graders. And he was taken aback because he just thought they were too old to be read aloud to. But it really turned out to be such a wonderful experience, not only for him as a teacher, but for the entire class, for so many reasons. And one of the main reasons was that reading aloud allows everyone to share the experience of the journey together that otherwise would just be impossible.
So it's an adventure, but in this case, a shared adventure.
Yes. When children read for pleasure, when people read throughout life, it does so many different things to the brain. First of all, it encourages the brain to think in sequence. And so that's a skill that's used in all different subjects. It also, over time, it actually physiologically changes the brain and gives it increasing neuroplasticity, which is the brain's ability to change. And I was surprised to find that reading makes us more empathetic. It makes we let go of everyday chatter and we begin to visualize, like you said, the characters in the book. And we're lost in that place with them and feeling the things that they feel and experiencing to an extent what they experience.
It's so interesting. When the novel came along and reading became really popular in the early 1700s, there were people who thought that it might be a pernicious thing, that if you got into a novel and into the plot and everything, some demon or other personality might take over your brain. You know, you wouldn't be able to, basically, they call it suspension of disbelief. Hmm. You know, you have to pretend, you know, to enter into a story to get with it.
Interesting.
And, so
I did not know that.
One of the big things I worry about now with all the e-information and the rapidity mm-hmm. with which things hit us is that our attention spans on average are declining.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm a little bit worried that us, especially adults, but kids especially, mm-hmm. will be able to handle a narrative that's longer mm-hmm. than a few seconds, because, again, the internet is not organized sequentially, mm-hmm. and you're constantly being peppered with stimuli. What are some of the ways you think reading can be promoted in these final minutes?
I just think I've learned so much about it as I've gotten older. And throughout a person's life, reading has health benefits. And if a person who doesn't like to read can just start with a little bit at a time and just allow your mind to open and allow yourself to sort of delve into the story, and you'll find it reduces stress levels by 68%. It boosts happiness and overall life satisfaction. It helps you fall asleep. It alleviates anxiety and depression. And it preserves brain health and lowers the risk of Alzheimer's and dementia.
Wow. Tell me about, let's go back to the middle school thing just briefly.
Mm-hmm.
That is a time of turmoil for kids. You know, your hormones are going wild and you're growing faster than you thought and you're shedding some of your kid attributes. And what do you think reading and that kind of stuff has to do with adolescence and growing into a more healthy adult, if you can read and interpret via the printed word?
Well, I think that it promotes the neuroplasticity, so that means not only that they can think, they can problem solve and think of different ways, easier to do things, but it also means that they can see things through another's eyes. And it actually stretches their mind. And so that means it's expanding their tolerance, everything.
What concepts would you like to leave with our listeners or you know, things that you want them to take away from our conversation?
Well, I think just to try it. I mean, if you're not a reader, then give it a try. Pick something you like. If it's just magazines, when I was growing up, there were books as furniture and magazines. And I can remember as I got older, starting to read my father's books, that different novels and mysteries and that he had up in a small bookcase that we had. And he was always a reader. So that set an example for me. And
starts in the family, doesn't it?
I think it does. I really do. I really, really do.
Today we were joined by local author and graphic artist Debbie Miklas. Thank you so much, Debbie.
Thank you for having me.
Next up on Issues and Ideas, we're going to talk about another kind of literacy, media literacy. In the second installment of our series on Media Lit, Michael Garrett from the San Luis Obispo County Office of Education sits down with new KCBX contributor Beth Thornton. Garrett is the technology coordinator and speaks to the importance of providing teachers and students with media literacy skills.
Michael, you recently blogged about the need to focus on information and media literacy skills. Can you define media literacy and tell us why it's important?
Sure, and I think there is some confusion in terms of the different terminology. Typically, information literacy is kind of a blanket term for the different types of literacies that we discuss in the digital space. Specifically, media literacy is really the ability to understand and analyze different media types. So whether you're talking about newsprint, online, whatever that happens to be. So under that space, you also have digital literacy, which is the ability to use digital tools to then be able to work in that space. You also have in that space digital citizenship, which is essentially your kind of code of conduct, how you navigate the digital space, as well as business practices and using safety, protecting your own data and things like that.
Can you tell us about your role?
My role is an educational technology coordinator for the county. One of the ways that we assist the school districts with their educational technology, specifically around media literacy, is around a web portal of resources that most of the school districts in our county have access to. And teachers have resources as well to assist with the instruction. So it gives them a number of different tools for pulling from encyclopedias or vetted images, things like that. And so we do trainings to support those as well. We also bring in resources from the state through the Department of Education and through other providers to assist with resources for the school districts.
How important is it that we focus on these critical thinking skills around media?
I think it's massively important, and the ability to think critically about the information that we're being provided, and even before that, to determine how we collect the information, right? So initially, we have to determine what we're looking for. So we have to think critically about our sources, what questions do we ask to begin with? If we're on the internet performing a search, thinking critically about the search terms that we use, looking at the search results, understanding that if you're going to Google, for example, your top results aren't going to necessarily be based on best, most accurate content, but there are a number of other factors that are determining what comes to the top, and understanding that it's another form of bias or advertising, in a sense, that how you're getting that content presented to you. So to think critically even before you get to the content is an essential piece. And, you know, looking beyond that, there are a number of different steps along the way that I think will be essential for students, not just in their academics, but as they go through life. If they're looking at articles on Facebook or any other social media, to understand the difference between a sponsored paid piece of content and an actual news article, for example.
There was a bill passed at the end of the year. It was introduced by Senator Dodd from Sonoma. The bill requires the California Department of Education to create a website of information and resources for California teachers and educators. The website will be up and running by July of this year. Does this seem like a good first step to you?
It does seem like a good first step. I know it's been a long time coming. There's been pushes for resource collections like this in the past. So I think with the rise of fake news and things like that in the media as a discussion point has been a real motivator to see some change in this space. I know that they had last May a forum where a number of folks from across the state got together to advise the group on what kinds of content should be available. I think that the information literacy toolkit that's coming out of that will be a positive first step. I do have a concern about another resource that teachers have to learn themselves, given all that they already have in terms of teaching their own discipline. But I do agree that it's a good first step.
Are teachers eager for this type of information? Are they coming to you and asking for training in media literacy?
Sometimes they don't necessarily know what to ask for, and I think that's part of the problem. They recognize the areas that they may be lacking, but they don't necessarily have the language to know know what to ask for. Certainly in the resources that we already provide, we try to train teachers on the different tools that allow them to frame the content in these ways. So we have a number of online databases, for example, and when they're using those to support instruction, showing them that there is a source, that there is an author, showing them how they can walk students through tracing those through to check the bias that may be coming from that publication or from that author, to be able to look at any supporting materials, media that may go along with it. There are a number of areas where I think that teachers need this and want this and may not know exactly what to ask for, but I think they see the benefit.
Production is also a big part of media literacy, producing one's own media. And kids who are online, they're making videos or they're sending pictures. I would think that it might be intimidating for teachers to have projects like that going on in their classroom.
Certainly from a technology perspective, I think it's really going to depend on the ability of the teacher, what their comfort level is. But the core concepts, I think, are really very similar. The whole idea of media literacy or information literacy is certainly not new. It's just a new mode of distribution that we're looking at now. And I think that a lot of times, because it's moving so fast, it's easy for an instructor to kind of feel like the students are leading them. And it's important to be able to step back and say, hey, let's re-examine this with these core tools that we already have in terms of assessing the content, thinking about voice, thinking about audience, and all those pieces that are essential. Because as you say, students are already and will continue to be producing their own content, and they're leaving a digital footprint that they need to consider. This is their online legacy, and is it what they want their voice to be as they move throughout their life? Giving students the ability to analyze and think critically about the content that's being presented to them, whether it's in an academic setting or in their own homes, can only be a good thing.
So in thinking about the parents, can they access some of these resources as well?
So there are a number of resources that will be part of the toolkit that are also applicable for parents that aren't strictly curricular-based, pulling from a number of commercially available resources, including the Common Sense Media's collections. There are collections from Project Look Sharp and Media Smarts.
Do you have any advice for our listeners about media literacy and using technology in the home?
Sure. I think, you know, the Pew report just last year that acknowledged that 45% of children are on the internet constantly as their own term. So I think it's important just to be aware that this is going on, whether it's at school, in your home, with your children's friends. So really just to embrace it and to understand that this is part of the space that we're living in, and to have dialogues with our children, right? So if you're sitting and watching TV, when an advertisement is showing us some new product, to just have that aside conversation with your child and say, what are they trying to show us here? Who do they think they're talking to? Why should we take their word on this? As well as when looking through any kind of online news, to ask those same questions. So just really instilling those critical thinking skills in students from early on.
Thank you for talking with me.
My pleasure.
That was Michael Garrett from the County Office of Education. I'm Beth Thornton for Issues and Ideas.
You're listening to Issues and Ideas on KCBX. More than 2,700,000 troops served in Vietnam between 1964 and 1975. Throughout the Vietnam War era, more than 260,000 women served in the armed forces of the United States, and an unsung cadre who volunteered to serve in Vietnam were the civilian women who worked for the USO. During the Vietnam War, 23 USO clubs served the troops in Vietnam and Thailand. Even though Mary Beth Breen Collins was a pacifist, her curiosity about the war got her to sign up for an 18-month stint as associate director of the USO Club in Vietnam, where she served from January 1969 to June 1970. Fort Hunter Liggett Army Reserve Base in Monterey County recently hosted a special event in conjunction with Women's History Month, honoring the women who served in Vietnam. Following a special commendation for her 18-month tour of duty with the USO, correspondent Tom Wilmer visited with Breen Collins.
Your memories of Vietnam have stayed with you forever.
That's for sure. It was the best of times, it was the worst of times.
And yet, it was curiosity that got you to Vietnam, wasn't it?
Yes. I'd spent time as a high school teacher in Iowa, having my kids write letters to GIs. And then I went to England and was teaching there and living with a pacifist family. And everyone I met would ask me, why are you Yanks in Vietnam? You know, that's so crazy. So when I had the opportunity, I thought I might as well go and find out.
So you went over in 1969?
Correct. January of 69.
And about 18-month tour of duty?
Yes, yes. Came back in June of 70.
While you were stationed there, what were some of the most poignant, powerful memories of your time there?
Well, a lot of them were very similar. You know, you'd be talking to young men. They would come to the USO and see an American woman there and want to talk, just pour their hearts out, or, you know, just keep in practice of talking to a woman, because they didn't see too many, and the idea was to give them a taste of home. Then sometimes their friends would come back a couple weeks later and they were gone. They had paid the ultimate price.
And you were stationed in a remote USO outfit. You weren't in downtown Saigon.
Right. I started out in Saigon, but our USO in Zion was about 25 miles north of Saigon in a little village. So we were only open during the day. At night, it was VC territory. It was an old French theater. And so we had a snack bar, and we showed movies in the afternoon and had pool tables and a music room where you could play the piano.
In a way, you had no fear. Maybe you didn't know no good enough.
Yeah.
But you took your Jeep and went out in really obscure places out in the rural countryside by yourself.
Yeah, probably foolishly, as my husband would say, what the do you think you were doing? But as I said, I have a guardian angel that works overtime. And
so you never really felt scared, did you?
I didn't.
You didn't?
Just
know.
Stupid to be scared, yeah. Until after it was over, and then somebody would say, do you know you just drove through a firefight? No. That's the way I operate.
Very fascinating. And there were other women that served with you.
Yes. Some of my best friends to this day. That at the time, there were about 25 clubs in Vietnam. And, of course, Saigon and Tan Son Nhut and Zion were relatively close together. So we did a lot together. And we would get an idea for an adventure and all take it together.
For example, give us an example.
Colonel at the PX one time saw one of my coworkers and I and said, sure would like to have you girls come visit my troops. And we said, well, you get us a chopper and we'll go. So he did, and about six of us went. And when we got back, our boss, who was in charge of all of Vietnam, called us in on the carpet. What do you think you're doing going over there? I have your passports in the safe. And I said, Sam, we didn't stop for any passports. We just flew
right
into
Cambodia.
Yeah. So, yeah, we would, anytime somebody would get us a chopper, we would go wherever.
It didn't matter where.
No.
So you were really up for the adventure.
Yes, exactly.
And yet it was a very poignant, sad time, too. I mean, you would be visiting with a troop in the USO, and hours later, he's dead.
And we would spend time going to the hospital to visit troops there as well. Yeah.
So when you got back from Vietnam, then you went to work for the airlines?
No. My husband was in the Army, and he was stationed at Fort Ord, so I taught at Seaside High School for 3 years. And then he joined the Foreign Service, so we moved to Washington, D.C., and I worked in a community college. And then when we were overseas, I would work in the embassies, and I did teach school in Berlin. But when we came back and our youngest was in finishing high school, I'd always said to my daughter, you're very good at languages. Go to work for an airline so I can fly free. And she never did. So I saw this ad for ground personnel. I thought airlines only had pilots, mechanics, and flight attendants.
Right.
But they have a lot of other positions. And so I worked in reservations.
So you went to work for United?
Yes. Yeah.
Very cool. So you did get around.
Yes.
And you're still getting around.
Yes, we have a son in Foreign Service, and he's in Mongolia, so we're going there next month.
Wow. Inner Mongolia or outer Mongolia?
I'm not sure. I'm going to find out when I get there.
Well, Mary, it's been wonderful to visit with you.
Thank you for having me.
You're welcome. I'm Tom Wilmer, reporting from Fort Hunter Liggett in Monterey County.
You've been listening to Issues and Ideas on KCBX, Central Coast Public Radio. Gary Eyster composed our theme music. A special thanks to all of our guests and contributors this week. I'm Tyler Pratt. Join us each Monday from 1 to 2 in the afternoon for more local stories. You can head to our website to learn more about what you heard today or listen to past segments. It's all at kcbx.org. Thank you.